Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. I gotta say, I just love the cartoonish nature of this one. I'm Ben. Get that out of the way. And I love cartoons.
Ben, I love cartoons too. And I also love the word cartoonish. And I really learned it from you. And I think a lot of listeners have, they'll drop that word like it's a nod to Ben Bolin. That's Ben Bolin speak. I love it. You basically like, it's not like you own the word, but it's certainly, you've got the Ben Bolin trademark of cartoonish down pat for sure. Ben, you know what I love?
What's that?
Delicious roasted meats.
Oh, you know?
Especially on a hand-turned spit over an open flame.
Oh, buddy,
you ever see that massive cone of meat at the Euro place, you know, where they shave it off the side? It really isn't the same unless it's got to be in motion, dude. That meat's got to move, my friend. That's where the flavor comes from. Everybody knows that.
Right. Yeah. It's just like at the Brazilian steakhouses. You remember those, Noel? Mm-hmm. You're Noel.
I am Noel. Yeah. Like Fogo de Chao. What do they call them? Gauchos, where they like, you have the little card that you flip over when you like, more meat. And they bring you the meat. And it's on a giant skewer that they literally take off of these racks that are like over these open flames. And they're just glistening with deliciousness and juices. Sorry if we're triggering any vegetarians out there right now, but sorry, this is an episode about rotating meat and hedonism and the weird ways throughout history that meat has been allowed to move.
That's true. This is one of those episodes that's going to leave the three of us, Noel, myself, and our super producer, Casey Pegram, incredibly hungry, ravenous, famished afterwards. You're right. It has been scientifically proven by us with zero studies or experiments.
Or oversight of any kind.
That the motion of meat is what provides the succulence, the flavor, all the juicy goodness. There's a great article in the Vintage News that gets us into this story where they talk about how in the cartoon The Flintstones, one of the running gags was to have animals taking the place of a machine, right?
Household appliance of some kind.
Yeah. Like, you know, the dishwasher was an octopus, or there was a bird, right, who would do something, and then there would be a weird, you know, sound cue, and the bird would be like, that's a living.
Was it like the faucet or something? There was definitely like a pig as the garbage disposal. I definitely remember that. And it just lives under the sink. And I guess the beauty there is like you're feeding the pig with your garbage, so you don't really, but then wouldn't it just like poop everywhere, though? It seems like that would be way more mess creating than it would be eliminating. What do you think, Casey?
I think you take that and you do composting and then it's all very sustainable.
Exactly. Casey on the case. But it turns out that wasn't so far-fetched. The operative word here being fetched.
I like that. That was good. It turns out that once upon a time.
Once upon a medieval time.
There we go. People did use animals to do some of the same things that machines do today. In the 16th century, there was a breed of dog whose entire existence was to assist humans in cooking meat. And it was known by the phrase, the turnspit dog. Off mic, I was talking with you guys about this over the weekend. And when I first saw the phrase turnspit dog, before diving into the research, I thought they were dogs made to be eaten, and I felt terrible, and I was wondering whether we should skip this episode, but luckily it's not. They had a different job, right?
No, and I sort of jumped the shark a little bit when I said once upon a medieval time. So we'll backtrack ever so slightly to before these dogs were employed. Back in medieval times, you know, in Britain, they would essentially just scoff at the notion of roasting meat in an oven. There's a book called Amazing Dogs, A Cabinet of Canine Curiosities by Jan Bondesen, and it talks about the evolution of this kind of doggy tech that led to the spit dog. Initially, though, in the 15th century, it was hard work to rotate this spit by hand. So if you were a chef, or you were, you know, you got a lot of other things on your plate, literally and figuratively, and so you're running around doing stuff, you don't have time to turn the spit with a crank by hand. So, you know, in these royal households and, you know, moneyed kind of gentry situations, you absolutely had to have your roasted spit meat. And in order to do that, you had to actually have someone whose entire job it was to rotate the meat. If you didn't have it rotating at a steady pace, you know, you would run the risk of it not being cooked evenly, or it being overcooked or undercooked or whatever. So you had to have somebody that was like rotating it by hand. And initially, it was children that did it. And this is kind of disturbing, actually. Apparently, oftentimes, it was such hot, sweaty, backbreaking work that the children would do this job in the nude.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, if they were wearing their clothes, they would get so hot that they could faint. And we can't have these spit children fainting, because what will happen to our meats? They will stop rotating, and that's not going to fly. So, you know, off with the clothes, young spit child. This is disturbing stuff. Apparently, they weren't even allowed to take breaks, and there are reports of them having to urinate in the fireplaces in Henry VIII's home of Hampton Court. It's pretty dark.
Yeah, they were called spit jacks, and they would maybe get a wet bale of hay. That was about what they had in terms of workers' rights. And this could be seen as, you know, like a funny sight gag in a comedy film. But this was a very real and very torturous existence. And this was also a luxury. It wasn't like if you were in the average family in England at the time, it's not like your parents would make you and your siblings draw straws to see who has to turn the meat all night. This is something that you would see more in like taverns or the homes of aristocracy. Mm-hmm. But by the 1500s, there was something that was kind of like the medieval version of outsourcing, because these kids, they weren't just living a rough life. They were also, frankly, often fainting just from heat exhaustion. And they get these horrific blisters on their hands, which means even when they weren't fainting, it was very difficult for them to work. So picture King Henry VIII, like a person in an infomercial, just dropping glasses and stuff. And he's going, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah, this filthy nude street urchin's open sores are getting all over my meat. That's a disgusting image, and I apologize, folks, but it's true. I mean, this was really untenable, and I imagine they had to have them kind of like off camera. You know what I mean? Like somehow, like pay no attention to the young lad behind the curtain turning the meat spit. So yeah, there did have to be another way, and it turns out that other way was what we know now as a turn spit dog, which in the 16th century really became the way, to get this done and to get the kids, you know, let's give them some you know, let's put them back in the stables, you know, give them some other kind of dehumanizing and dangerous work, but you know, we're gonna relegate spit turning to these dogs, a particular breed of dog, in fact, right?
That's right. You could see a depiction of this in some old drawings. We found one that was on, I think, through Amusing Planet. But let me just describe this to you. So there's a bench and it's clearly a tavern kind of restaurant. People are sitting there, families having food and drinks, and there's someone who works at the tavern watching the fire where a leg of what appears to be, you know, lamb or beef is slowly turning on the spit, and it's attached through this system of pulleys to a hamster wheel kind of hanging, a wooden wheel hanging from a roof beam. And there's a tiny dog just Forrest Gump level running his heart out in the wheel to turn the meat. There is also a cat who is on the, you can see at the bottom, who's just sort of staring in idle curiosity at the dog.
I was thinking maybe the cat was there to, like, you know, like as like a stick and carrot kind of approach, you know, like the cat is what the dog is constantly running after in place, you know, on this little hamster wheel. Because I do wonder, like, I mean, that requires some training. You know, I would think a dog eventually would get bored of just running around on a wheel. There would probably be some abusive tactics that would go into making sure these dogs never stopped, right?
Yeah, or maybe they're just very energetic naturally. The way they're described reminds me a little bit of dachshunds, of wiener dogs, because they've got short legs, they've got a long body, drooping ears. The zoologist Carl Linnaeus called them Canis vertiginis, dizzy dog.
Dizzy dog, because they were always running around in circles. So let's talk a little bit about this apparatus that had to be like custom designed, like for this purpose, you know, because the kids were essentially turning a chain or like pulling a lever kind of situation. Obviously, dogs don't have hands, so they had to kind of manufacture something that would allow the dog to use its like locomotion to constantly turn the spit. So basically, it was a hollow wheel, just like a hamster wheel, with an axle connected to it, and that would turn the chain or strings that was attached to the spit and keep it rotating at a steady pace as the dog would run. Just like a hamster wheel, the spit would turn. And they were able to locate the device away from the actual spit to keep the dogs from getting too hot, which you got to wonder why they didn't figure that out for the kids. Maybe that would have kept them from, you know, passing out constantly. Seems like they gave the dogs a lot more attention and care than they did these children.
Yeah. And maybe if I'm being optimistic, I could say that it's a lesson learned from their first time out the gate with this abusive practice. But maybe, like many people, they just liked dogs more than they liked humans.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like the Nazis and horses.
Right. Like the Nazis and horses. The dogs had a number of uses, but they also had almost like workers' rights. I'm not sure how to say it. They had Sundays off. And they also, you know, when they were done with kitchen duty, they were given another job. They were trained to sit on their owner's feet to keep them warm in manor houses and in castles, which are famously drafty.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to harp on this too much, but it's crazy. They gave the dogs Sundays off and the children worked round the clock year round. I mean, I only assume it wasn't something that we came across of like, what days did the kids get off? Didn't seem like they did. Really bizarre and interesting. So let's talk a little bit more about the actual breed. We talked about a name that was given to it. What was it, Ben? Canis vertiginis or dizzy dog?
Vertiginous? Dizzy dog.
Yeah, exactly. This was, you know, much like dachshunds with their short legs and long kind of slender bodies, I believe were bred for a particular type of hunting initially in Germany.
That's true. The British dog breeders were looking for specific qualifications. It had to be a dog that was small enough to fit in a wheel. Irish wolfhound wouldn't fit the bill. You know, they had to be super strong, they had to be energetic, and they couldn't be dummies because you had to be able to train them to do some specific things.
And they definitely didn't want them to talk back like those pesky animal appliances in the Flintstones.
Or have hands like those pesky children.
Exactly.
So according to the Kennel Club in London, the first mention of them occurs in 1576 in the first book on dogs ever written. This is the book of English Dogs by John Caius. He said that they so diligently look to their business that no drudge nor scullion can do the feat more cunningly. Drudge and scullion being names for kitchen staff at the time. And did we say its other Latin name yet?
Oh, the vernepiter cur. Right.
What's that mean?
It's just essentially like kitchen dog or cooking dog, if I'm not mistaken. I love the idea of a cur. That's sort of a term of abuse, an old-timey one, like, you cur, you villainous cur, which I guess is a dog. I didn't really realize that until looking into the research for this episode. But yeah, I mean, it is a good example. Like I was talking about dachshunds being bred specifically for hunting. It was for hunting specific types of small game, like badgers, which I thought would do it for you, Ben, and other types of rodents and smaller things. So they wanted to be lower to the ground so they could like wiggle into some of the smaller spaces that those creatures would go. And it's the spit dog, according to this book, The English Dogs by John Caius, was a really good example of breeding an animal for a specific purpose.
And to be honest, they have a little bit of a spotty history. We've been being very nice to the kitchen staff. These dogs were well known in contemporary society. People wrote about them. Shakespeare has a dog mentioned in the Comedy of Errors. And the hard truth of it is that these dogs did not have a good life, right? Like, yes, they didn't work on Sundays, but the kitchen staff usually got Sundays off. Yes, they got to hang out with their owner and keep their feet warm, and that's, you know, gives us all the cute fuzzy feels. But we have to remember that these were not ornamental pets. These were dogs with a function, and they were treated pretty roughly.
Yeah, and it wasn't until, you know, animal cruelty groups like the ASPCA or the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals started kind of taking notice of, you know, animal rights. The idea of animal rights was not a thing. Like, it was really like animals were here for us and we would do with them as we pleased. But this gentleman, Stephen L. Zawatowski, with the ASPCA, talks about the history of these spit dogs and says that they were so low on the social order that nobody took account of them, which kind of leaves the history a little bit open-ended. And then there actually is, if I'm not mistaken, a taxidermied turnspit dog on display at the Abergavenny Museum in Wales. The dog's name is Whiskey, by the way. And this animal is described by Stanley Coren, who wrote a book called Paw Prints on History, as having a very similar body shape to a basset hound with the head of a pit bull. So we're sort of using our imaginations here and thinking about what these dogs might have looked like. I think we're both on the same page in picturing a dachshund type situation. A basset hound is also similarly kind of longer with little stumpy legs, but it does seem to be a breed that we wouldn't really see these days. And, you know, it's interesting how breeds kind of fall in and out of favor. And if you don't keep breeding them, then they're going to eventually, like, you know, die out. And obviously there are hundreds and hundreds of breeds of dogs throughout the world, often bred for very specific reasons. And like, here's a few examples from this cool Medium article that we read, Turnspit Dogs, the Original Rotisserie Machines. For example, Jack Russell Terriers were bred to hunt rats, and Border Collies were bred for herding sheep, and Greyhounds were sleek and quick so they could hunt hares. And then Alsatians were guard dogs. So there were all these very specifically bred characteristics. Turnspit dogs really, really did have a rough life. I mean, they were denied some of the just most basic necessities that you think of in terms of like a dog. Dogs overheat really quickly. They need a lot of water to stay hydrated and to be healthy. And apparently these spit turn dogs would work in teams where they would, there'd be like, you know, one working and running its little heart out on the wheel. And then when that one overheated, essentially, it would be replaced by another dog, and they would trade every couple of hours. And even though they did try to locate the wheel a little farther away from the spit than it would have been with the early examples with the kids turning it so close to the actual spit, because it was just a chain that was directly on it, it still was very, very hot. And a lot of this dry heat would hit the dogs, and they weren't getting water. So they would really kind of, they were almost being tortured, you know?
Right. And it went even further than that. You see, some of the more villainous cooks involved in this situation might actually put hot coals on the wheel if they thought the dog was moving lazily. So they would threaten it with burns. You know, I've been silent for a second here, and it's not because I don't want to talk about this story. Just a peek behind the pandemic curtain. We usually try to avoid recording on Mondays because that's when my friendly neighborhood leaf blower does his weekly concert outside of this window. I think he's using art and audible evil as a way to work through his own issues. So we've had to stop and start this a couple of times, but I'm going to give it a go. If you hear anything in the background, just know it's a terrible person.
Definitely a super villain in the making. But what are you going to do?
We'll power through it. I'm kidding. You know, maybe we'll see if we can get him on the show one day.
That'd be fun. That's a great idea.
And he can explain the terrible things that led him down this dark road.
Why he is the way he is. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So the torture I am enduring is nothing compared to what these poor pooches went through. Like you said, Noel, they were not provided water on a regular basis. And if they were laboring under heat exhaustion, some villainous cooks who would be like leaf blower operators today would just say, you know, these dogs are lazy, and they would put hot coals in the wheel where the dog was running. And so now the dog is doubling its efforts because it is running in fear from being burned. This is a level of abuse that, like you said, was quite common before the rise of animal rights.
There's a fascinating story, and I don't know, it almost seems a little bit fictionalized or overblown, but who knows? In the annals of Bath, a historical account of the time, there was a story about on the Sundays that the dogs were off, they would often be taken to church with the kitchen staff. And apparently on one Sunday service, the preacher was telling the story of Ezekiel and the wheel in the sky. And according to this account, the third mention of the word wheel, all of the dogs in the sanctuary bolted for the door. So, you know, take that one with a grain of salt, but it definitely speaks to the levels of abuse that these dogs were experiencing, if it's true.
Right. Yeah. And you can see other authors writing about this in the Illustrated Natural History from 1853. John George Wood notes that the dogs were very aware of their shift, for lack of a better word. If they weren't relieved at the proper hour, their innate sense of timing would kick in, and they would jump out of the wheel without any orders, and then they would force their companion, their fill-in, to take their place. And there was another author named John Cordy Jefferson, who wrote in a book about the table, I think, a fanciful story about the relationships that turnspit dogs had with their canine coworkers.
Yeah, it goes like this. It's a little bit long, but I think it's worth kind of taking you there and setting the scene. Abused by men of all degrees and scorned by every other dog of the house, a pair of turnspit dogs were continually snarling at and fighting each other. Each accused the other of shirking his fair share of their common work and devouring more than his fair share of their common ration. And in their mutual rage, they would sometimes fight to the death. Buffon tells the story of a turnspit dog that, on escaping from the wheel in the Duke de Lionfort's kitchen in Paris, ran in upon his fellow turnspit and killed him because the latter had, by sulking, compelled him to perform an additional spell of work. A similar incident occurred at the Jesuits' College of La Flèche, where a turnspit dog, infuriated by being compelled to work in the wheel when it was his turn to be resting, had no sooner escaped from the cage of torture than he hunted out his dishonest comrade and, after a brief conflict with him, took his life. Wow. These were violent little fellas, weren't they? I guess, you know, that's essentially the kind of attitude you're going to breed when you're living this life of constant servitude and survival. That, wouldn't make the most friendly animals. I wonder if they were infamous for, like, you know, attacking other household dogs. We talk about how they were like on the lowest possible rung of the social strata in dog terms in these households. I bet they would be punished very severely if they were caught nipping at the treasured actual lap dog of the family.
Yeah, it's a good question. And again, the history is spotty because these dogs were not considered especially important. Right? They were, it's like, why would you write a history of a specific kitchen gadget, which, by the way, are the exact kind of books I love reading. Give me 500 pages on the rise of the blender or the spork, the fapoon.
What's another good one? Like the zoodler? Have you ever seen a zoodler?
Ooh, what's a zoodler?
It makes noodles out of like vegetables,
zucchini and stuff.
Also, you know what the most dangerous kitchen appliance or gadget is that I own, at least, is a mandolin. You know, it's made for like julienning things. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy when you're scraping things on this plane with these crazy sharp blades to accidentally slice your entire hand across that thing. I've done it more than a couple times, and it's like getting clawed by a vicious cat with like metal talons.
What sacrifices will we not make in the pursuit of great cuisine? Mm-hmm. Which is a really messed up way to look at turnspit dogs. But also, we're not heaping opprobrium on just the British. It's very easy to do so because that's where most of the reports come from. But lest you look down on our cousins across the pond, please remember that there's evidence of turnspit dogs being used in the early United States. Pennsylvania's founder did it.
That's right. And in the Pennsylvania Gazette, which was Ben Franklin's publication, you could pretty regularly see ads being run for both the turnspit dogs themselves and the wheel apparatus that we're talking about. Pretty interesting. There's an account of William Penn, the founder of Pennsylvania, and his wife, Hannah, through some letters that were found, asking friends in England to ship them over a new wheel for their personal turnspit dog.
Yeah, this makes me so sad when we think about this. And I'm glad that the practice is no longer common. It was very widespread, like we'd said earlier, in 1750. You could find turnspits anywhere in Great Britain. They were ubiquitous. By 1850, they were becoming scarce. And by 1900, they were functionally gone, which was a very good thing. These new spit-turning machines called clockjacks were replacing turnspit dogs left and right. And according to Jan Bondson, who wrote Amazing Dogs, A Cabinet of Canine Curiosity, it ultimately became a sign of poverty to have a turnspit dog instead of a steam-operated clockjack. And the author here says that these turnspit dogs were, quote, ugly little dogs with a quite morose disposition, so nobody wanted to keep them as pets. This just breaks my heart. I feel like every dog is great. It's just a reflection of its owner. So I think these dogs could have really blossomed with a little bit of TLC if they weren't forced to run on a hamster wheel for hours while someone was throwing coals at them.
Yeah, I mean, at least the hamster gets to just do it for fun and a little exercise. I mean, can you imagine, like, I mean, it's the very definition of, like, interminable to be forced to run on a wheel forever.
It's Sisyphean, you know?
Oh, it's, yeah, it's really is the tortures of the damned, my friend. The tortures of the damned. No pup deserves that life. And it was these types of abuses. We mentioned this in the form of a quote early on, but that led to organizations forming with the novel goal of protecting animals from this type of abuse. It was the turn of the 20th century which saw animal rights activist groups being created for just that reason, because of all of the absurd, you know, abominable abuses that had been, you know, heaped on animals throughout history. So you've got this guy named William Woys Weaver, who's a food historian, talking about the treatment of turnspit dogs in an 1850s Manhattan hotel. And it apparently angered his friend Henry Berg so much that it actually inspired Berg to found the ASPCA in the 1850s. So the ASPCA literally was founded because of the abuses that turnspit dogs were going through.
And since the institution's inception back in 1866, it has helped reduce the suffering of hundreds of thousands, probably millions of animals across the country. So something good did come out of the tortures of the now extinct turnspit dog. And if you wanna look at one, like you said, Noel, the best example is gonna be Whiskey, who is taxidermied. But if you want to watch the closest thing to a living one, a lot of people recommend you check out the Corgi, which is like the fancy version, the turnspit dog as the peasant version of the Corgi.
Love a Corgi. And, you know, nowadays, those dogs are more bred for just cuteness. Maximum cuteness is what you get with a Corgi. And there's another silver lining here. And I think this is a great way to wrap up the episode. Some folks were a little kinder and gentler to these turnspit dogs. Queen Victoria, for example, kept three of them as house pets instead of kitchen tools, as the Atlas Obscura article that we've been referencing points out. And there is a poem from a book called The Book of Days, which describes the life of a turnspit dog named Fuddle. And here's how this one goes. The backstory is that Fuddle is so angry at his fellow turnspit dogs, as we pointed out in a previous account, that there was often rivalry and sometimes fighting to the death between these. But there was also in this story an evil cook, and the two dogs were fighting over like a pile of bones. And this is how the poem goes. He licked his lips and wagged his tail, was overjoyed he should prevail, such favor to obtain. Among the rest, he went to play, was put into the wheel next day. He turned and ate as well as they, and never speeched again.
So last thing I'm going to say, I think I speak for a lot of our fellow listeners when I say 10-10. I want to see the Turnspit Dog movie. I want Pixar to do it. I want it to be about a plucky group of turnspit dogs, and maybe like a lovable scamp human kid in the kitchen, a spitjack. And I want them to bust out, and I want them to go on an adventure, and I want them ultimately to do like a, I don't know, some kind of like Homeward Bound thing mixed with a little bit of Finding Nemo. And I want one of the dogs to be played by Steve Buscemi.
Love it. Oh, and with those Steve Buscemi eyes too, I could totally picture that.
Right.
You know, I got to add, Ben, I think it'd be fun if this turnspit dog was dreaming of a life as a greyhound racer, like, because he's, you know, like he wants to break out, because he's the best turn spit dog, as he runs the fastest and the steadiest, but he really is secretly dreaming of racing alongside those sleek greyhounds, which was a thing. I think greyhound racing, it was even a thing in medieval days, where, because they were again bred to hunt rabbits. So that would be cool. I love like that kind of fish out of water story. And then you got, and then all the greyhounds are like, nah, you can't, you're not in our league. Little short stubby legs, you can't, you know. And then he shows that he's got moxie with sheer will and pluckiness. The turnspit dog does compete and prevails.
Well, he's got, you know, eventually they meet royalty at the end of it, who are amazed, right? And the kitchen scamp, who plays a much bigger part in this story, is, you know, like the number one human representative, kind of doing a ratatouille thing. And he gets adopted, or she gets adopted, and they live happily ever after. But the dog always does still have Steve Buscemi's voice. And I think I want him to turn out to be the narrator. We'll play with time a little bit. But we won't play with this time, because this is the story of the turnspit dog. And luckily it does have a somewhat positive ending.
Yeah, agreed. Really enjoyed these two episodes that we did this week. Sorry, Casey, didn't mean to trigger you with all the British stuff. I know that you're staunchly you're on Team France.
Did you send this leaf blower guy, Casey? Is this your retaliation?
You know,
wow.
There's a lot of stuff you can get on Fiverr, I'm just saying.
You son of a fish. Okay.
Oh, my God. And he's diabolical. Absolutely diabolical. But we love him all the same. As do we love Alex Williams dearly, who composed our theme. Christopher Hatsiotis here in spirit, as always. Mm-hmm. Gabe Lugier, our research associate extraordinaire.
Yes, and Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. If he had a Facebook relationship status with Ridiculous History, it would simply say, it's complicated. Thanks also to dogs in general. Man, I just love dogs. Send me pictures of your dogs. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter as a show. We love recommending Ridiculous Historians, but you can also find us as individuals.
Yes, I am exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me on Twitter at Ben Bolin, HSW, or you can find me on Instagram at Ben Bolin, BOWLIN. So there you have it. Who let the dogs out? It was the age of machines.
It was the ASPCA mainly.
I think it was, but there was also the steam operation aspect.
That's,
you know,
true.
There was this turnspit dogs had a John Henry moment.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.